trees bow down to the winds of the east. No, without words, and the wind blows. When the winds of the east apart, when the winds of your love, when the winds of the east apart, when the wind.
Beloved Book One, once Joshua was asked, "What is the special teaching of your school?" Joshua's response was, "Though the folding screen is broken, the frame is still there." At another time, the same question was asked of Joshua, and he replied, "Ask in a loud voice, I'm hard of hearing." When the monk had repeated the question in a loud voice, Joshua said, "You ask me my special teaching? I know your special teaching." Once, Joshua was asked to go to a Korean temple to a meeting. When he reached the gate, he asked, "What temple is this?" Someone answered, "A Korean one." Joshua said, "You and I are oceans away." On another occasion, a monk asked, "When a beggar comes, what shall we give him?" Joshua answered, "He is lacking in nothing."
Manisa, this is the last night of the lion's roar. Before I discuss the sutras placed before me, I have to give you few hints to understand Joshua and his lion's roar. A lion is a special symbol. It walks alone. unafraid of any danger. He has nothing, but still he is called to be the king of the jungles. A man of enlightenment has some similarities to it. He walks alone. Although there may be thousands of dead bodies following him, it does not take away his aloneness. His aloneness is something of his inner being. No crowd can take it away. There is no way for anyone to approach it. And he walks on a dangerous path. Most of the people have remained outside themselves for a particular reason. To go in is a little dangerous. The outside seems to be familiar, well known. You know how to deal with it. You are well acquainted with it. You are educated and conditioned to relate with it. But you don't know the language of the inner. And you don't know the sky of the inner. And you don't know where you are going. You don't have any map. You don't have any guide. Nobody can come with you to help you. This creates tremendous fear. People remain their whole life outside, engaged, keeping themselves occupied. They don't leave any time gap in their occupations. Because in the time gap, they may become aware of something of the unknown that is always there. One day it happened in a New York church. As the bishop entered in the church, he found a young man just looking like Jesus Christ. But he thought in his mind that this fellow must be a hippie. But what a similarity. He asked the man, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" The man says, "I thought you will recognize me. I am Jesus Christ." The bishop became really afraid. Who knows? He may be. But he may be just deceiving. That too is possible. He immediately phoned the Polak Pope to Rome. asking him that a young man to me who looks like hippie, but also looks like Jesus Christ, is standing here. Now what I am supposed to do, because I have never been taught, I have never thought in my life that I will ever encounter Jesus. The Pope remained silent for a moment because he himself was not prepared for such a situation. But something has to be said to the poor bishop. He said to the bishop that just keep yourself occupied, don't pay any attention to him. Everything is possible. He may be Jesus Christ, he may be hippie, and inform the police. Meanwhile, you keep an eye on the fellow, what he is doing, and you yourself keep occupied in anything so that you don't become afraid or frightened, and call the police. It's strange that if a Jesus appears into a Christian church, this will be the welcome. With the unknown, somehow our whole stomach gets disturbed. We don't know how to respond, because our whole teaching is, our whole upbringing is to react to particular conditions. We have already the answer. Our mind functions almost like a computer memory. Our educational system goes on pouring information into our mind computer. So whenever a situation arises for which you are already informed, you don't get frightened. You are well prepared, you have done the homework. But for the inner, you are absolutely unprepared. Entering into the inner forest, one knows nothing what is going to happen and whether he will be able to find anything valuable, or whether he will be able to come back again. I have come across a man. His wife has brought him to me. The man has become afraid of sleep. And his argument was perfectly right. He said, what is the guarantee that I will not die in my sleep? Who knows, I may not get up the next morning, then what? Sleep takes you in your deeper unconscious, inwards. you may go on so deep that you cannot come out. The wife said, now he is driving nuts the whole family. He does not sleep. And he goes on asking everybody, are you asleep? Now to ask a sleeping person that are you asleep is to wake him up. And that is the whole strategy, that everybody should be awake. Alone also he is afraid that everybody is asleep and he is left alone waking. If something happens, there is nobody to look up to. So neither he sleeps, nor he allows anybody to sleep. He must have been taken to many people, to doctors, to psychiatrists. And finally somebody suggested that it is better to take him to a crazier man than he is. So I agreed with the man. I said, you are absolutely right. Your wife is wrong, your family is wrong, and anybody who says to you, she laughed and looked at the wife and said, see, a wise man understands, and you have been taking me to idiots. I told the wife that you go away. Your husband is really doing the right thing. The wife said, you are creating more difficulty. Now, up to now, at least he felt that he is doing something wrong. He should not do, but he was helpless to do it. Now he will be absolutely right and everybody else is wrong. I said, that's the truth. He is absolutely right. So you go away. We have made a communion. Leave us alone. Just for few minutes and he will be back. The man said, it's strange that in the whole city, you are the only man who understood my situation. I said to him that this is the situation of the whole humanity. Nobody wants to go in. The fear of going in is going into the unknown, in the darkness. And the same fear has taken over you in concern with sleep. You are a spiritual man. Just you have not understood the reason why you are afraid of going to sleep. He was very happy to hear that he is a spiritual man. Everybody was thinking he is insane. I said, you are so spiritual that death cannot do anything, any harm to you. You can sleep perfectly well. He said, you are certain? I said, I am certain. He said, then it is okay. I will sleep. And if you say that I am a spiritual man, then certainly I should not be afraid of death. the whole phenomenon of spirituality is not to be afraid of death, because death is a fiction. It does not happen. Your innermost life principle is eternal. I said, by the way, you have found something very essential in the search of every man. Your fear is absolutely right, because you don't know that you are deathless, that you are beyond death. Just go home, go to sleep, and I will come in the morning to see you. In the morning I went. The whole family was puzzled that how I have managed. That man slept after many days. In the morning he was very fresh and he said, you are right. Sleep has nothing to take away. Not even death has anything to take away. Death, after all, is a longer sleep. Zen particularly in the hands of Joshua becomes a lion's roar that resounds in far away mountains and valleys. A man who knows life as an experience, not as an explanation, only is capable to give a lion's roar. To wake up other lions. I have told you the story, very ancient story, about a lioness giving birth to a child. While she was jumping from one hillock to another hillock, the child fell into a crowd of sheep and grew amongst the sheep. There was no way to know that he is not a sheep. Perhaps that was the only vegetarian lion in the whole history of animalhood. Absolutely vegetarian, just eating grass. But even eating grass, he started becoming bigger than the sheep, longer, a beautiful specimen. But the sheep were not afraid. They never thought that he is dangerous. He has grown amongst them. They have relations with him, friends, and somebody mothered him, somebody was taking care of him. There was no question of being afraid, just they were concerned that what a strange kind of sheep looks like a lion. But must be a natural mistake. And they were very happy that they have amongst them, while they moved in thousands in a crowd, he stood aloof in the middle of them. One day an old lion saw this phenomenon and could not believe. He has never seen any lion walking in the crowd of sheep. The moment the sheep see the lion, they start escaping. It was a miracle. The old lion went down to catch hold of the young lion. The sheep started running, and the new young lion also started running. Naturally, he believed he is a sheep. But the old lion was just a man like Joseph. He got hold of him and he started trembling. And the old lion said, "You idiot, you are trembling and weeping and crying and asking that you should be relieved, you want to join your group. You don't know something. It seems you are unaware, and I will not leave you unless I make you aware. You come with me." He dragged him to a nearby lake. The lake was silent, no ripples, no wind was there. He took the new lion by the side of the water and told him, "Look in the water. Look my face and your face." Instantaneously, from the young lion, a roar came out. It was not any effort. It was simply the fact of seeing that he is a lion. Immediately a roar that resounded in far away mountains, the old lion said, "My work is done. Now, do you know who you are?" The young lion thanked the old lion and said, "You have been very kind to me. Otherwise, my whole life I would have lived chewing grass with the sheep, continuously afraid of being alone. You have given me a new birth." That's exactly the function of a master. To create a situation in which the lion's roar comes spontaneously, the recognition of your being. And Joshua was a great craftsman, immensely capable of devising new methods to wake up those who are fast asleep and completely unaware of their being. These sutras will help you to understand his methodology. Once Josu was asked, "What is the special teaching of your school?" Now, such questions are very ordinary and common. You can ask to any philosopher, you can ask to any priest, any pedagogue, but you cannot ask such a question to a Zen master. That is where the Zen master is a complete different category. Because Zen has no teaching what to say about special or not special. It has a method of awakening you, but it has no doctrine, no theology. It does not teach you anything. It simply wakes you up and leaves you liberated. It does not program you for anything. Its function is finished. The moment you are aware, your very awareness will become your discipline, your compassion, your love. Your actions will be transformed by your awareness, not by rehearsals, not by repressing the opposite. What are teachings? What are doctrines? Ways of repressing to teach you that you are a Christian, you should love even your enemy. Now, in the first place, if you are really a man of love, how can you find an enemy? And if you have an enemy, then it is going to be absolutely difficult to love him. It is difficult to love even the friend. And if you want to know the ultimate fact, it is even difficult to love yourself. Because you don't know what you are, you don't know what love is. So what you will do, you will simply impose, you will become a hypocrite. Every Christian, every Mohammedan, every Hindu, every Buddhist is nothing but a hypocrite. He has to cover up all jealousy, hate, cruelty, greed, and cover them up with beautiful disciplines practiced well. But howsoever you practice them, what you are doing is simply repressing. So what you have repressed remains in you. and will come out any moment. There was a Christian missionary who used to say in every sermon, quoting Jesus, that if somebody slaps on your one cheek, give him the other cheek also. Everybody loved the teaching. It is beautiful. But in one village, one idiot created trouble. Hearing this, he stood up and slapped the priest on one cheek and asked him, "Now give me the other cheek." The priest was boiling with anger. This has never happened. This is strange. But still he contained his anger. It is only a question of one cheek more, then he will see. He gave the other cheek, and that man was so stupid. He hit him again on the other cheek. Just as he hit him, the priest jumped on the man and started hitting him here and there, everywhere. The man said, "What are you doing? Have you forgotten your sermon?" He said, "There are only two cheeks." And Jesus had said nothing beyond that. Beyond that, I am free. So how long you can? Once it happened to Gautama Buddha, a man was going to spread the teaching of his master. He asked him that if somebody is very unkind, cruel, how many times I have to forgive him? Because that was the teaching of Buddha, forgive. But the problem is, how many times? And in the very question, how many times, it shows that the man has not forgiven. He is just repressing. He is asking how many times to repress. Reduced to its exact meaning, Buddha said 7 times. That man said, "Okay." 8th time, "I am absolutely free." Buddha said, "You have not understood my idea. What do you mean by 8th time you are absolutely free?" He said, "8th time, I will kill the man. 7 times I have forgave him. Now it is enough." Seeing the situation, still people who make doctrines and moralities and principles to live by can't see the underlying repressing. Buddha said not 7 times, but 77 times. Buddha's chief disciple, Sariputra, said, "It does not make any difference. Even if you say 777 times, it does not make any difference. Because after that, he is free." And he is waiting for that moment when the principle comes to an end and he can show his reality. All discipline is limited. You cannot condition a man absolutely. You can cover up a thin layer, but just scratch the layer and immediately all discipline is forgotten, all Christianity is forgotten, all Buddhism is forgotten. Immediately your animal comes out. Hence, masters like Joshua have immensely improved on Gautam Buddha. Although they are disciples of Gautam Buddha, he has shown the way, but the way is always capable to be refined, more refined. Joshua has done a great contribution. He has no teaching, no special teaching. He simply wakes you up and then it is up to you how to live. If your wakefulness does not prevent you from being greedy and ambitious, hateful, jealous, revengeful, then nothing can transform you. The ultimate principle of transformation has been given to you. You are awake, alert, responsible. Now you are free. You can do whatever comes spontaneously to you. There is no abiding teaching, no abiding theology. You are your own decision, your own discipline. That is the beauty of Zen, that no religion has got it. Once Joshua was asked, what is the special teaching of your school? Joshua's response was, though the folding screen is broken, the frame is still there. The man who has asked him was his own disciple. He is saying to him, though the folding screen is broken, the frame is still there, the frame of the window. The screen is broken, but the window is still there. You have been with me. You understand that I don't have any teaching. So you are asking, what is your special teaching? Must be to the very intimate inner circle you give the special teaching. So the folding screen is broken. A part of your mind that there needs to be a teaching is broken, but only a part. The frame of the window is still there. You are again asking the same thing just by joining a word special. There is no teaching and there is no special teaching. Zen is the only way of life which has nothing to teach you. It exactly does what the English word education means in its original roots. To educate means to bring out what is inside you. It is almost like drawing water from a well. All our educational systems are doing just the opposite. They should not be called educational institutions. But such is the blindness and such is the unintelligence, the retardedness of the people who decide the fate of millions, the politicians, the priests. They can't see a simple thing, that your educational institutions are feeding from outside things into your mind. They are programming your mind. They are not doing education. They are not drawing your life to the circumference. They are not drawing your innermost awareness to your life. I have been fighting with the Indian government for my whole life, but they cannot understand a simple fact that this is an educational institution. And what you call educational institutions are not. They are programming schools. But it is almost one man against the whole world. They go on denying that this place is a place of education. They don't understand the meaning of the word at all. Zen is not a teaching, but it is an education. It draws out whatever you have in your innermost core, the joy, the bliss, all the flowers that are possible, compassion and love, all the songs that are hidden in you, all the dances, all creativity. You are part of a creative universe. You must have some part to play in the whole creativity that is going on everywhere. But your so-called educational systems, rather than bringing anything out from you, just do the opposite. They force things upon you. Your religions do the same. Your society, culture, everybody is doing the same. Nobody is careful of the delicate seed . They go on throwing all kinds of rubbish, and the seed is covered, is never given the right soil, is never given the right climate. Its season never comes. It never becomes a sprout, green and living and radiant. It never becomes a foliage. It never brings roses, which you all are carrying. I am calling those roses hidden in you the Buddha. Everybody is carrying a Buddha within him, just it has to be carried out. Devices have to be made so that you can carry out your center to the circumference. This is the only education in the world. Everything is a teaching, not education. And teaching is always in the favor of the vested interests. Teaching can never be revolutionary. The teacher is the servant of the vested interests. Only a sannyasin can be a revolutionary, because he has no vested interest, no obligation to any investment. He is liberated himself from all connections, all dominating forces. He stands alone. He is capable of giving a lion's roar, which may trigger in you also the same roar. Only very few sannyasins in the world have been authentic rebels. Joshu is a great rebel, a whole rebellion. At another time, the same question was asked of Joshu, and he replied, "Ask in a loud voice. I am hard of hearing." It was also from a disciple, and everybody knew that he is not hard of hearing. He just wants to wake up the man by asking him to speak loudly. Perhaps speaking loudly, you may come out of your sleep. Have you ever experienced that in sleep? If you speak loudly in some dream, you are immediately awake. You can go on talking in a normal way, but there are situations in dreams where you have to scream. Perhaps you are falling from a cliff and you have to scream. And suddenly you are awake. Every nightmare ends up in your waking, because the nightmare brings to a position where you have to scream loudly. Nobody has commented on Joshua's question. Even in the Zen circles, that why he asked in a loud voice, "I am hard of hearing." When the monk had repeated the question in a loud voice, Joseph said, "You ask me my special teaching? I know your special teaching." The man was a missionary type. He was a disciple, but he was a disciple just to gather some more knowledge, so he can go pretending to be a master himself. He missed the whole device. If he had understood why he is saying speak in a loud voice, and he knows that he is not hard of hearing, then there must be some point to be understood. He is asking for loud speaking so that you can wake up. But he missed the point. He repeated the question in a loud voice. If he had got the point, he would have touched the feet of Joseph. Because in awareness, there is no teaching, no special teaching. Just one goes on acting spontaneously, whatever situation arises. One is a mirror, goes on reflecting whoever comes before the mirror. Awareness is just a mirror, and your response is not a repetition from an old teaching. Your response is fresh, of this moment, even you were not aware that you will respond in this way. Because you are not repeating a memorized answer. You are simply responding with full awareness, seeing the situation. Whatever is needed in this moment comes out of you from the very center, not from the memory, but from your very being. The man missed, and because he missed, Josu told him, "You ask me my special teaching. I know your special teaching." Zen is a very subtle game. It is very delicate. You have to be very alert and watchful. What is happening? Josu said, "You are asking my teaching. I have not asked your teaching, but I know your special teaching. Because all that you have are the scriptures. Everything is borrowed. Nothing is your own contribution. So everybody can know what is your special teaching. He did not say to him that you missed directly, but indirectly he has pointed to him that all teachings are borrowed, all disciplines are borrowed. A man of awareness acts in the moment according to his own awareness, not according to some principle. But all the religions are full of principles. And those principles have destroyed humanity, its awareness, its responsibility. I have told you, when God made the world, he went around asking different people, to the Babylonians, to the Egyptians, that, "Do you want a commandment?" The Babylonian says, "First, we would like to know what is the commandment. Without knowing, we don't want." He said, "You should not commit adultery." The Babylonian said, "Then what shall we do?" "Keep your commandment." He said to the Egyptians, "You should not steal." And they said, "Life will not be so juicy. We are not interested in such commandments." Stealing is a game. And then he met Moses, and you can see immediately the response of Moses He did not ask what are the commandments. He immediately asked, how much? God said, it is absolutely free. He did not even ask, what are the commandments? He simply said, then I will have 10 if they are free. Now those 10 commandments are not only just in the Jewish tradition. Similar commandments are in every tradition. You should do this, you should not do this. Times change, life goes on changing. But those commandments remain heavy on the heart. For example, Muhammad gave the commandment to Mohammedans that you should not take interest on money. Now the whole business depends on interest. If Mohammedans are poor, and they are poor everywhere around the world, the simple reason is that they are still following a strange idea that you should not give or take interest on money. Now, no bank can give you money without interest. Even the richest people go on borrowing money from banks because they can earn much more than the interest. But the Mohammedans are carrying a heavy principle on their hearts that it will be a betrayal to the religion if you take or give interest. So obviously, they are poor. In India, poorest jobs are being done by the Mohammedans. It is just an example Zen emphasizes the fact that man's consciousness in its ultimate form is enough to decide how to respond in any particular situation. So the only thing important is to become as much conscious as possible. All these commandments are for children. Once Joseph was asked to go to a Korean temple to a meeting. When he reached the gate, he asked, "What temple is this?" Someone answered, "A Korean one." Joseph said, "You and I are oceans away." He is saying that The Buddha cannot be Korean, cannot be Japanese. Awareness belongs to no land, to no country. How can be this temple be Korean? It is a temple of Buddha. It cannot belong to any country, to any nation, to any race. Buddha belongs to the whole humanity. Because the very word Buddha simply means awareness. It is not his personal name. His personal name was Gautam Siddharth. When he became awakened, those who realized his awakening started calling him O Gautam Buddha. They dropped his personal name Siddharth. The word Buddha comes from a Sanskrit root Budh. It simply means one who is fully awakened. How awakening can belong to any country? That's why Josu said, you and I are oceans away. Although we are standing in the same temple, but the distance between you and me is oceans away. You think it is a Korean Buddha? It is a Korean temple? Can't you see that Buddha consciousness is simply everybody's? It is not the monopoly of anybody in special. It is in the normal course, everybody has to become one day a Buddha. You can avoid it as long as you want. You have been avoiding for centuries. But you cannot escape, because it is your intrinsic nature. Sooner or later, you are bound to be fed up with the outside world and look inwards. And that inner reality belongs to no nation. On another occasion, a monk asked, when a beggar comes, what shall we give him? Now, in English translation of the word beggar, there is bound to be some misunderstanding. In India, what you call beggar is called bhikhari. And Buddha called his sannyasins another name which also means bhikhari. He called them bhikshu. Both the names can be translated as beggars, but both the names are as far away from each other as possible. The bhikshu is one who has renounced all ambition, who has renounced the objective greed, who has renounced all jealousy. The bhikshu is one who has found himself, and now he is enough unto himself. He does not need anything more. So bhikshu is a very respectable, honorable word. Bhikhari is just a beggar. Now this translation, when a beggar comes, what shall we give him? You should remember, English does not have another word like bhikshu. It is when a bhikshu comes, what shall we give him? One who has renounced everything, one who has found oneself, who has found one's nothingness, what shall we give him? Josu answered, he is lacking in nothing. That answer will make you clear that the word beggar is not an appropriate translation. A bhikshu is one who is lacking in nothing, who is so contented, you cannot give him anything, he needs nothing. He has come to a place where he is absolutely satisfied. So the bhikshu is really the emperor. Without any outside empire, he has an inner empire which is far more valuable than anything in the outside world can be. So Josu said he is lacking in nothing. Please don't think that you can give him something. But the translation gives a wrong turn. If you call it, when a beggar comes, what shall we give him? A beggar is not a bhikshu. A beggar has come to beg. He has all the desires and all the ambitions, everything. Begging is his profession. I have heard about a beggar who used to stay by the side of a bridge where there was much traffic, and one man every month when he will get his salary will give him something. Just by chance it was a little late in the evening that he came back from the office. He has been given his salary, so he wanted to give something to the beggar, but he found that somebody else is sitting there, but it does not matter. That beggar used to be blind. This too is blind. So he gave him a 1 rupee note. The beggar looked at the note and said, "This note is fake." The man said, "You are blind. How did you manage to see it?" He said, "I am not blind. This is not my place. I used to be blind before, but people were cheating me just because I was blind. They will give all kinds of false coins, and I could not say anything because I was seeing that they are cheating me, but what to do? So I dropped being blind." Now I am deaf. And my friend who used to sit here has gone to see a movie today. So he said, "Just you take my business. It is only a question of 2-3 hours and I will be back. But I have not seen a movie for many days." Beggars have their accounts in the banks. And they are as desirous, perhaps more, than other people. They don't have anything. They want everything of the world. English language is poorer in the sense that it does not have any equivalent word for bhikshu. It is better to remember that bhikshu is not a beggar. Bhikshu is a master. And the tradition in Zen is when a bhikshu comes, because he needs just food for one time. You give him food and you feel obliged that he thought you worthy enough to ask for food. So first you give him food and then you give him something as a thankfulness, that you are grateful to knock on my door, a man of your quality, I also hope someday I will also be in the same consciousness as you are. But even to provide food for you just for one day is a great virtue. You have made me happy and accept my thankfulness so he may give a blanket or something that can be used by the bhikshu. A bhikshu is not a beggar. Then only Josu's answer will be right. He is lacking in nothing. So you cannot give him anything. You can only ask for his blessings. You can only touch his feet and feel gratitude that he allowed you to touch his feet. Su Tungpo wrote, in the teachings of the creek sounds, in the purity of the mountain's hues, 100,000 hymns came to me last night, but today how am I to talk about them? In a very beautiful way, he is saying that last night in the teachings of the creek sounds, in the purity of the mountain's hues, 100,000 hymns came to me last night, but today how am I to talk about them? They were so beyond words. They were so existential experiences that even if I want to say something about them, it will not be right. Only silence, perhaps, may be able to convey something. Are a dance, are a song, but a straightforward prose will not help. This is not only about the creek sounds, it is about every aesthetic, spiritual, mystical experience. When it overwhelms you, you feel you will be able to convey it. But when you try to convey it, you find utterly helpless. No word seems to be the right word. No language seems to be appropriate to convey the depth, the height. In fact, mind is not made up to communicate the inner experiences. Inner experiences are only transfers from one being to another being. It is a heart-to-heart communication. Head-to-head, it is impossible. Manisha has asked a question. Beloved Bhagwan, what is the difference between a puzzle and a mystery? Manisha, a puzzle is soluble. However difficult it may be, but you can find the solution. The mystery, the more you search, becomes more mysterious. You cannot solve the mystery. You can only dissolve into it. I have heard about a professor of mathematics. It was New Year's Day and he wanted to purchase some toy for his child. Being a mathematician, he looked for some mathematical puzzle. The owner of the shop said, "I have got absolutely the right thing for you. I know you are a great mathematician, and this is the latest toy. But before giving it to your child, please try yourself to solve it." The mathematician tried to solve it this way and that way. In every way, it was wrong. Desperate and perspiring, because it was looking very awkward, other customers gathered, the salesmen gathered, the owner was watching. With tremendous interest, everybody was watching that whether a professor of mathematics is going to solve a simple child's puzzle or not. And finally he gave up. He said to the owner that, "I don't see any way to solve it." He said, "You need not be so sad and don't perspire and don't be worried. This toy is made in such a way that any way you try, you will be wrong. This toy is meant for a certain purpose, to teach the children that this is how life is. You try it anyway, you will end up in a wrong place." And you can ask anybody. Everybody has ended in the wrong place. It is very rarely to find a Buddha who ends up in the right place. Otherwise, everybody is trying hard, but reaches always to the grave with empty hands. A a puzzle Manisha can be solved, the mystery cannot be solved. That is the difference. The mystery becomes more mysterious as you try to solve it. And sooner or later you find the mystery is so big that by and by you are dissolving into it rather than solving it. Kabir's one of the most important mystics of India, a statement is worth remembering. Herat, Herat, He Sakhi. Kabir Raha Hirai. He is saying, my friend, I was searching and searching, and rather than finding, I have lost myself. The mystery is in which you will be lost. It will dissolve you. You will become part of the mystery itself. But the puzzle is a small thing. It can be solved. It is time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. Mike and Stella McManus live on a small island off the west coast of Ireland. They have 14 kids. And life is hard. One day Mike decides that he has had enough. Stella, he shouts, I'm leaving you. So he jumps into his little rowing boat and starts rowing towards the mainland. Leaving Stella standing on the beach. But Mike, what about the house? Shouts Stella. I'm sorry, Stella, replies Mike, but I'm leaving you. And he keeps on rowing out to the sea. But Mike pleads Stella, what about the children? It is no good, Stella, replies Mike. I am leaving you. And he keeps on rowing. But Mike, cries Stella, pulling up her dress and displaying her feminine charms. What about this? Ah, God, mutters Mike, rowing back to the beach. One of these days, I am really going to leave you. Kowalski and Zabriskie go moose hunting every year in Canada to try and catch moose for the local zoo. This year, as usual, they hire a seaplane and a pilot. They fly deep into the Canadian wilderness and land on a lake. As the pilot drops them on the shore, he gives them a warning. "Now remember," he says, "only one moose, or we will have too much weight to take off again. I will be back to pick you up in a week." The plane takes off into the air, and the two Polacks, armed with a crate full of vodka, take off into the wilderness. 1 week later, they are standing on the shore with two moose when the plane arrives. "I told you guys, only one moose," cries the pilot. "Come on," replies Kowalski. "Last year the pilot took us with two moose. He was not afraid." Eventually, after a lot of vodka and persuasion, the pilot agrees and they push the two moose into the plane. The plane starts from the shore, but there is too much weight to take off, and they crash into the trees at the other end of the lake. The moose escape and run off into the forest. Kowalski and Zabriskie wake up and look around at the wreckage. "Where are we?" asks Zabriskie, completely dazed. "Ah," says Kowalski, looking back at the lake, "about 100 yards further than last year." Kevin McMurphy, a good Catholic Irish boy, goes to see the priest, Father Dingle. "Father," says Kevin, "my wife, Kathleen, is going to have a baby." "Praise the Lord," exclaims the priest. "Yes, Father," says Kevin. "And it being our first, Kathleen and I were wondering if you could be praying in the hospital chapel while she's delivering it." "Say no more, my son. It shall be done," says Dingle. "And bring along your parents and Kathleen's family to help with the praying." When Kathleen goes into labor, Kevin phones Father Dingle and both sets of parents, and half an hour later, Kevin is pacing up and down outside the delivery room. When the nurse sticks her head out, it is a boy. She cries, and Kevin runs downstairs to the chapel, where everyone is praying. "A boy, a boy," cries Kevin, and dashes back upstairs. As he arrives back at the delivery room, the nurse pops her head out and cries, "Now it is a girl." "Holy Jesus," cries Kevin, and runs back down to the chapel. "Twins," shouts Kevin. "I am the father of twins. It is a girl." Father Dingle and the families start singing Hail Marys to the Blessed Virgin. Kevin races back upstairs, and as he reaches the delivery room, he hears the doctor say, another boy. Kevin turns around and rushes back down the stairs, flings open the door of the chapel and shouts, "Triplets! Triplets!" cries Father Dingle. "Yes," screams Kevin. "And for God's sake, stop praying!" Never know. Close your eyes. Feel your body to be completely frozen. Now look inwards with total consciousness and with a great urgency, as if this moment is your last moment. One should live the same way. Every moment is the last moment. Then only one can live totally. Go deeper, make a spear of your consciousness. The moment you touch your center of being, all over flowers will start flowering. Just be a witness of the silence, of the peace, of the deep contentment. Of the immense sky that opens up from your center. To make it more clear, Nivedana, simply witness. You are not the body, you are not the mind, you are only a witnessing consciousness. This witnessing consciousness is the door to the divine. This witnessing consciousness is what we have been calling the Buddha. This Buddha has to be brought to every act, to every gesture, to every word, to every silence. It has to become a reality 24 hours. Only then life is a perfection, a completion. One has come home. Gather as many flowers and the stars and the fragrance. You have to bring the Buddha with you. Soon Nivedana will be calling you back. As you get up with grace, with beauty, with silence, with immense blissfulness surrounding you. This moment the night has become the most blissful it has ever been. This moment, the Buddha auditorium is just a lake of consciousness. You all have disappeared in it. 10,000 Buddhas. Have just become a lake of consciousness. Nivedana, come back, but come back as Buddha. With as much grace as possible, with great serenity and silence, few minutes just to sit and recollect where you have been, remember the center and the path that leads to it. You have to go on this path again and again till your circumference and center become one. Till you are a Buddha without any doubt. It is everybody's destiny. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, Bhagwan.
Thank you. beyond the questions, deep in silence, beyond the answers, beyond the fears. Here we are, here we are, here we are, here we are. This, ah, this, ah, this. Beyond the answers, beyond the fears. Here we are, here we are, here we are, here we are. This, ah, this, ah, this, ah, this, ah, this, ah, this, ah, this. Beyond the laughter, beyond the tears, beyond the questions, deep in silence, beyond the answers, beyond the fears. Here we are, here we are, here we are, here we are. This, ah, this, ah, this, ah, this, ah, this. Beyond the questions, it's deep in silence, beyond the answers, beyond the fears. Here we are.